I'm Phil Latzman. We welcome you to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN, our weekly mission to keep South Florida informed on local, regional, state news and issues affecting our community from Key West to Tallahassee. And we do that with a panel of the area and the state's top journalists. And this week, they are veteran CBS 4 WFOR television reporter, investigative reporter, multi-award-winning journalist in his own right, Al Sunshine. Welcome back, Al.
Great to be here, Phil. Thank you very much.
Also with us from El Nuevo Herald, the Miami Herald's Spanish language edition, is editor Teresa Frontado, who's joined us on this program before to tell us about the adventures with Venezuela's elections and, of course, coming up this weekend. More to talk about. Teresa, welcome back to the panel.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
And I believe, are we good for Tallahassee? Toulouse Olorunipa is a reporter for the Miami Herald's Tallahassee Bureau, and he joins us, I believe, from our sister station WFSU in Tallahassee. Hey, Toulouse, welcome back.
Hey, Phil. Good to talk to you again. Thanks for having me.
So we're going to talk about all kinds of things. We'll start, though, with the news of the week here in the region, and that is the Dolphin Stadium Initiative. It is now official, as county voters will decide next month whether to allow public money to renovate Sun Life Stadium. That is, if state lawmakers approve of the idea first. The Miami-Dade Commission voted this week by an overwhelming majority to let county voters decide in May if hotel taxes should be raised to pay for the Dolphins to renovate Sun Life Stadium. County Mayor Carlos Jimenez, who helped broker the agreement with the team, called it a good deal.
We can't get everything we wanted. They can't get everything they wanted. They obviously didn't get everything they want. But I didn't get everything I wanted either, okay? And that's the art of negotiation.
Dolphins are promising to pay back the money in 30 years. The team is also vowing to bring several high-profile events to the area, including Super Bowls and college football championship games, and say they'll return the money if they're not awarded these big games. Al, you've seen your share of these negotiations played out over the years. How does this one compare, and what do you think they've done it to? The Dolphins done enough to convince voters that this is worth it?
I think that, like an iceberg, there's probably a lot going on under the scenes now. I think that we're in the very, very early stages. And as far as what the Dolphins may be doing or the opposition, I think, again, they're probably strategizing. They're probably putting together campaigns between now and the public vote. And it's going to be very, very interesting to see what's going on both above the scenes and below the scenes. The whole issue is going to be for a community that's still got a fairly bitter taste in its mouth over the Marlins Stadium. Are people going to be willing to support more public tax dollars going into a private sports group? And it's going to be a real interesting thermometer for us to see where we are.
And it'll be May 14th for this referendum for Miami-Dade County voters only. Teresa Frontado, what do you think? The Dolphins have made their case and are going to convince people that this is the right thing to do?
Well, I've heard it both ways. I've heard some people say, "Well, this is a better deal. The Dolphins have done a very good job of making an offer that's interesting for the community, especially saying, okay, the franchise is staying, and we have this agreement to give money if we don't bring more revenue." But there's also some other people that are still bitter about what happened with in Little Havana and with the construction of the Marlins Stadium and all those promises that were not fulfilled, you know, in terms of workers, in terms of taxes, and a whole other set of issues. So it's going to be interesting to see how it plays in the next couple of weeks.
And how is it playing in Tallahassee, Toulouse, where it is contingent upon state lawmakers to authorize Miami-Dade County, mainland Miami-Dade, to raise its hotel tax by 1% to pay for this whole thing? So it depends on what happens there. What do they think about it in the Capitol?
All right. That's very true. This entire deal could fall apart if things don't work out here in Tallahassee, even after the deal in Miami-Dade County. It's a bit interesting. There are some interesting politics going on. The bill has started to move through the process. We're about 3 weeks away from the end of session, and anything could happen. The opposition mostly is actually coming from Republicans who control the legislature. There's a minority of Republicans that are against this and say that it's corporate welfare. But the bill and the Dolphins do have a very strong lobbying team, and they're working through the process. And They're trying to get the House version and the Senate version through. They've made it through very, very many committees, and they're going to get to the floor pretty soon. And if they do, it could get to the governor's desk, and the governor has said that he's warming up to the idea of signing a bill if it meets all of his requirements, and it looks like this bill does.
And you mentioned the opposition and the Miami-Dade delegation is not for it, at least at the moment. If some commissioners in Miami-Dade County, it was an overwhelming majority of those that voted for the deal and then the referendum, but Esteban Bovo was not one of them. He argued that the Dolphins should be offering more concessions in return.
While this is not the Marlins deal, the pressure has started to ratchet itself up a la the Marlins deal. You know, no Super Bowl if we don't do this. Have to have an election in order to meet this deadline, and I don't think public policy should be done that way.
So, also, the Dolphins have now launched their own campaign, formed a political action committee called Friends of Miami First. It's co-led by well-known local attorney H.T. Smith.
The people of Dade County are guaranteed to either get a return on their investment because the Dolphins will pay the money back like a loan. And if the Dolphins don't do what they're supposed to do in terms of bringing in Super Bowls, etc., they will get a return of their investment. They have to give the money back.
So, Al Sunshine, the Dolphins are now aggressively pursuing this. Do you think it'll pay off for them in the end?
I think it's going to pay off in the end, depending on what the results of the election, if they're even held, are going to be, because it's going to raise the awareness in the community that for us to maintain the attraction of a first-class sporting NFL-style event like the Super Bowl, somehow there's got to be a way to pay for the infrastructure. Somehow there's got to be a way to attract the owners, the players, the interest to continue to come down here. And whether this works or not, I think it is going to enlighten a lot of people that infrastructure has to be fixed. It's got to be maintained. It's got to be improved. It's got to be brought up to the state levels that we're competing with. Whether it happens or not may ultimately be up to local and state politics, obviously.
And Mayor Jimenez had been a vocal opponent of public fundings for stadiums, was a critic of the Marlins deal, and he's led the effort here, ironically, to get this deal done.
Well, I could tell you, personally, I remember years ago the very, very bitter political fight going on between Joe Robbie and the old City of Miami Commission over renovating the Orange Bowl, and the bottom line is Joe Robbie decided to put his pants on one leg at a time, come up with the money, and do it himself. And I think that there's a very interesting discussion if that could have been done back then to build that stadium. You know, should current owners consider
But then
their
Joe Robbie
plan?
Had to sell off the team. His son had to sell the team to because of the estate tax that was passed down, if I'm remembering this correctly, from the early 90s. So everybody learned a lesson from that, and that's why they won't. You know, and Stephen Ross probably has a little bit more money, I think, than Joe Robbie did.
Well, there's a price to be paid both personally for the ownership of a sports club like either the Marlins or the Dolphins, obviously. And it really gets down to the nitty-gritty of, does Miami have enough economic clout as a community, both public and private, to support a first-class operation like that?
And you say, why wouldn't the Dolphins write this check? Well, Stephen Ross has already written checks. In fact, an audit shows he's already written a check of $42 million. There's a story by Doug Hanks in the Miami Herald yesterday. Written a check of $42 million to make up for a shortfall in the Dolphins' budget. The team is an estimated $380 million in debt, third highest in the NFL. You know, the Dolphins today have been kind of honest brokers about this, where the Marlins have kind of been shifty. So do they deserve, I mean, it's the same question, they deserve to be looked at in a different way, and I think Mayor Jimenez is considering this differently than the Marlins.
Well, you can say that they have been honest brokers, and also I think as a city we have wised up. We have had to pay a high bill for the Marlins, and I'm an optimist, so I'm hoping that it is that we have wised up as a city and we have realized that this is something that needs to be taken seriously, and there's some things that need to be in writing, and we need to go through all the nitty-gritty details before we commit to this.
and hopefully people will be reading up before the referendum if that does happen on May 14th. You're listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Phil Latzman. That's Teresa Frondado from El Nuevo Herald. I'm going to talk about the Venezuelan elections and some Cuba stuff as well later on in the show, and turn local and do some state stuff with Tulu Oronipa, who's in Tallahassee for us, and Al Sunshine here in the studio as well with CBS 4 Television on just about anything else. We asked members of the Public Insight Network in Miami-Dade County, because they're the ones going to be voting, if they felt the Dolphins had done enough to convince them, and here's a sampling of what we heard.
My name is Rick Exposito from Miami Beach, commenting on if the Dolphins have done enough to convince me on the public funds renovations. I think they have. I think the Dolphins are, Ross is putting up his money. What they're asking for is minimal, I would say. I mean, it's not like the Marlins deal, and you have to also think these are the Miami Dolphins.
Yes, my name is George, and I'm calling about the Dolphins. My only, as far as objections up to this point, is that I feel that Broward is getting a benefit while Dade County is paying.
So there's that's interesting, because we put this pin query out to Miami-Dade folks. A lot of Broward folks are for this. This is sort of interesting. What people don't know this, that the tourist tax would be for Miami-Dade County, although the stadium's right on the border. Broward gets about 50% of the revenue, or at least the hotel visitors. So there's this thought of unfairness. At Tulu, it's kind of strange to look at it, but you know the difference there, and the stadium's right on the border, and Broward gets the benefits and doesn't have to pay the taxes.
Right. There was an amendment put on by a Miami-Dade lawmaker, or offered up by a Miami-Dade lawmaker who's against this deal. And he tried to tie in Broward and have Broward actually have to commit and pay some of these taxes as well. That amendment failed. Of course, the Broward lawmakers were against it, and the Dolphins were against it as well, because they thought that might actually kill the deal. But that is part of the party dynamics. There's a split among the Miami-Dade delegation. The rest of the state seems to be on board. They've all been lobbied pretty heavily on this, and they all seem to be on board with it. So Broward is off the hook, and it could be that Dade ends up paying the full bill.
And we asked, have the Dolphins convinced you that the renovation should get public money and how it compares to the Marlins deal? Donald, also from Miami, with a vested interest, as he'll be voting next month. Donald, welcome to the Florida Roundup. You say you've changed your mind.
Yes, I have. Initially, I thought, here we go, the Marlins thing all over again. And still, I started looking into the specific details of the two plans. And I really think this is a much more favorable plan for the public for a variety of reasons. Number one, they're picking up 70% of the cost. The Marlins Stadium shifted 80% to the public. Secondly, a cost of $167 million versus a 40-year bond on the Marlins Stadium that totals over $2 billion. Hmm. And lastly, the promotional value and the economic value of modernizing Dolphin Stadium in terms of attracting Super Bowls and major sporting events adds a lot of promotional and economic value, in my opinion, to Miami-Dade County that the Marlins Stadium never will.
Thanks very much, Donald, for the call. And Carol is in Coconut Creek, and she also supports the deal, although I should say Coconut Creek is in Broward County, so I guess it's kind of a no-brainer for you guys, Carol.
Well, thank you for letting me call in. I actually represent Associated Builders and Contractors, which are commercial contractors throughout the state. And we represent about 130 companies in Miami-Dade County alone that are very interested in the opportunity to bid and potentially work on this project, both on the short end with the immediate jobs that would be created, and then in the long-term maintenance and service contracts that are incorporated with this type of development.
Okay, well, thanks for chiming in. I think that that speaks to the sort of the regional aspect of all this. We appreciate that. Now, one thing before we go to the break, the in the backdrop has been the Marlins, who opened up this week to just about the worst way you could possibly begin a baseball season. 34,000 did show up for opening day Monday. Record low crowds, though, followed. The Marlins were swept by the Braves. They've already been shut out four times in nine games. They're off to a 1-8 start, and I crunched the numbers. 1.7 runs per game. Now, the record is the St. Louis Cardinals in 1908. They scored just 2.4 runs per game, so they're on the track for that. But is it too easy or too early to say to Marlins management, I told you so? Who wants to go first? Al?
I think sports fans in this town are basically saying, look what's happening. We predicted this. We knew this was going to happen. I think that season ticket holders, if they were to be calling in, they wouldn't be happy. And I think it hasn't taken too long in the season for us to see perhaps, you know, what's ahead for baseball fans here in South Florida.
Against the Braves, who have a pretty good following. They got less than 14,000 on Wednesday night. Today says, you know, Venezuelans love baseball. Do they love baseball in Miami? I mean, does anybody love baseball in Miami?
Actually, there's been a lot of talk in the Cuban community about the new pitcher. I don't know much about baseball, but the pitcher that opens the game.
Oh, the starting pitcher.
Starter. Yeah, starter. He's a young Cuban pitcher, and he's been doing a wonderful job. There's a lot of
well,
buzz in the community.
It speaks
volumes
that we unfortunately don't even know who he is, and I'm a sports guy, and I don't.
Read it in Nuevo Herald this weekend. We have
an interview with him. My joke is the 2013 Marlins, who's on first, what's on second, I don't know who's on third. So we'll leave it at that. Thanks to all who participated through the Public Insight Network and elsewhere in that discussion. And we'll continue it, of course, online. I want to mention we're having a conversation online on our website at WLRN.org, being hosted by our social media editor, Danny Rivero. I'm Phil Latzman. With us, Teresa Frondado from El Nuevo Herald, Al Sunshine from CBS4 Television, Talus Oronipa from the Miami Herald's Tallahassee Bureau. And we're back in just a moment. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Riled up Marlins fans in here. I'm Phil Latzman, and welcome back. Our guests, Al Sunshine, Teresa Frondado, Talus Oronipa, and we welcome your questions for the panel. We're going to shift gears to Venezuela in just a moment and state stuff in a few minutes, but you can email us with your first name and location to thefloridaroundup@gmail.com, and we're also reachable by phone at 800-743-WLRN. We are tweetable all the time at call sign at WLRN. I'm at Phil Latzman. Teresa, you want to give yours out for the Twitter folks?
Yes, at T. Frontado.
And Talus, you might want to spell yours out for everybody.
Sure. Please follow me at TOLUSEO. That's Talus O. At Talus O.
And Al, you haven't joined the Twitter revolution, but CBS Miami is...
CBS Miami or Facebook, I'm all over it.
Okay, there you go. So anyway, let's move on to what happened, what's been happening to the south of us in Venezuela. Let's hear this little clip here.
To all the resources of government, or particularly of the oil company, of PDVSA, are at the disposal of the government to get voters out. They can be very intimidatory because they say, listen, if you don't vote for Maduro, you're going to lose your subsidy. If you don't vote for Maduro, your daughter's going to lose her job. If you don't vote for Maduro, this kind of thing.
So that was Robert Botom, who's the publisher of Ven Economica, a Caracas economic and political journal. That is reporting on the elections in Venezuela this week. We're going to hear some sounds from the streets of Caracas, but not important because the Venezuelans are going back to the polls. They're going to be voting in this presidential election to replace Hugo Chavez, who died of cancer last month. Steve Inskeep from NPR has been in Caracas all week. Teresa, I don't think there ever has been this much attention, even during the last presidential campaign, this much attention and focus on Venezuela on an international basis.
Well, I certainly wish it was not the case. I certainly wish we had a more regular process or election process. But it has been a bumpy ride since last October with the health problems of the president and all the silence around it. And then the president died and there was this kind of a vacuum. And now they call for elections and it was a very compressed campaign.
30 days, but you can only campaign for 10 days, right?
Exactly. And on that, you need to add the fact that the official candidate, the acting president, controls most of the media and access to official media. So that leaves the opposition in a very uneven situation.
Yeah, there was a report on NPR this morning about how the media is, well, there's an opposition media, and I think, is it Global Vision, which
was up for sale.
Right, up for sale, and they're looking to be bought by somebody who's a friend of the government, but there's been a lot of pressure on them that they're perhaps the only source out there that people can get alternative news. But how much has the media played into that role of coverage
and getting this presidential election wrapped up.
I think there has been an interesting campaign in the sense that the opposition has wised up and not that they were not before, but they have taken it a step further in their usage of social media. For example, the promotional videos that Enrique Capriles Radonsky, who's the opposition candidate, did for the campaign were designed or thought of specifically for YouTube, thinking in advance of the fact that they were not going to be
able
to get
TV coverage.
Yeah. So they're very, you know, compressed and designed for that medium, and they have been the opposition has been using the social all the power
social
of
media.
Social media to transmit different messages. They have a specific hashtag. They have different apps that can play with your name, and you can put it on your Facebook profile for Facebook fans like Al. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of movement on Twitter. So they have wise up, and it shows that in the 21st century, not everybody that controls the media controls the message. There are several other ways to use it.
And what about Maduro? He's kind of dressed like his former boss. He's talked like him. He's bringing pictures of him on the campaign trail. I mean, literally trying to embody Hugo Chavez in this sort of macabre way as he's campaigning. How does it look from here? What's been going on with the Maduro campaign?
Well, it's a little bit of magical realism in a way. I mean, it's been an interesting campaign, put it mildly. See how he keeps on using references to Chavez, and how he even changes his voice in certain when he's talking in his discourses and trying to mimic his voice. In a way, he is right on message. I mean, he is there because he was anointed by Chavez, and that's what he wants to say. That's what he keeps on repeating over and over and over. He got heavily criticized for this Twitter, for his bird, little bird anecdote, and has mm-hmm. been made fun of. But, you know, you give it to him. I mean, he's a message. His message
consistent.
Is, yes, his message is, I'm here because I am, that's his claim to fame, nothing else. His claim to fame is Chavez chose me. And he's been on message about
that. And what about Capriles? He lost in October, but some say he's been waging a different campaign. He's being more aggressive now. How has he changed his tactic here, trying to pull off this upset, Capriles?
Yes,
the governor of Miranda State.
He jumped into this totally energized, and I think you have to recognize that he has been going around the country. He's been more, because that was one of the critiques that, you know, after he lost the elections, they say, well, some people say, well, he was too passive, and he tried to ignore certain things that should have been addressed. So he's been more on the attack. He's been more, more aggressive.
More direct.
More direct. He's also has been more vocal about the fact that there are problems with the electoral system. The way that it's been designed is not necessarily advantageous. And there's some irregularities that need to be addressed, and the government has not addressed.
I know you're going to be going, as a Venezuelan American, you're going to be going to vote. Describe the process. Describe what you're going to be going through this weekend.
Well, there were the consulate here in Miami was closed, and it was the biggest electoral center outside of Venezuela. 20,000 people are registered, and we were moved. Or if we wanted to vote, we need to go to New Orleans. So that's pretty much the same groups that in October.
Did in October?
Yeah, they organized. I mean, there's several ways of going. There's some people that are going to be going by bus. It's evidently it's a more economical option. There's some other people that are going to be going by air, by flight, by commercial charter flights. There's even a foundation that has been receiving donations, and it's my understanding, I was interviewing them for a story for the paper, and they say that they have received significant number of donations of people that necessarily are not going to vote, but they want to help somebody else to vote, to take them to New Orleans. So there's going to be approximately 10 charter airplanes leaving Miami and going to New Orleans at different times during the day. There's a whole logistics set in place where they're going to be picked from the airport and taken in a special bus, and then everybody's going to go in a certain order to guarantee that there's a continuous flux and try to prevent the long lines, because what happened in October, that there was a long line in mm-hmm. the morning, and then there was a period of nobody. So it's going to be an ordeal. Or it's going to be a long day for a lot of people.
Well, we look forward to hearing and reading what you're going to be reporting back. You know, Al, six figures population, Al Sunshine from CBS4, by the way, and Teresa Frontado from El Nuevo Herald. Tulu Olorunipa is in Tallahassee. We're going to talk about state stuff. He's Miami Herald's in the Miami Herald's Capital Bureau. So I think I lost my train of thought there, Al. But no, there's a lot of people here. You learn to see people every day from Venezuela that have come here as a result of what's happened in the past 15 years and even before.
I think it is absolutely incredible that the political process in Venezuela shuts down one of the key population centers for Venezuelan Americans and Venezuelan citizens in the United States. And, you know, here's a question for you. You know, in effect, are we looking at gerrymandering where, you know, they're trying to have such a disincentive for local Venezuelans to be able to easily and logically cast their ballots? You know, are we almost like a victim of the politics there by having our consulate closed and you having nowhere else to vote but having to go all the way up to New Orleans?
Right. When are they going to get the consulate open, by the way? That's another thing, right?
Well, there's been a lot of debate as to if the rights of the citizens, of Venezuelan citizens here, have been violated with this disposition. And it's actually one of the reasons to prevent this criticism. That's one of the reasons why the government said, okay, you guys can go to New Orleans. So you cannot say you cannot vote. You can vote, because for a while last year, we were not assigned anywhere, so you couldn't vote. So now you guys can vote.
Much of a movement to try to get the consulate open to make it a lot easier for Venezuelan citizens to vote here?
There has been petitions circulated. There has been protests. There has been demand. But it is not in Venezuela's current government to open it, because this is a place where historically opposition has won elections and where people from the opposition are here.
So what does that mean for the likelihood of you being able to vote in a convenient area in South Florida?
Oh, dear.
Oh, dear.
Not this time. That's for sure. Move on. And obviously, next week, we're going to have a whole bunch of coverage on that as far as what happened, the results. But then a couple of things also of international Latin America import. The story of the Tampa couple charged with kidnapping their two young children, whom they lost custody of. They traveled to Cuba to flee authorities. Joshua and Sharon Hacken took their 2 and 4-year-old boys from the grandparents who had custody, sailed to Cuba to get away, but when they arrived, they were kicked out by Cuban authorities. Are you surprised, people at El Nuevo, surprised that the Cuban government was so cooperative and did not let this fester?
Yes, we were. We were glad that this did not become a political pawn. Custody issues have been sensitive.
Right.
In
and
both countries.
Elian, they kept talking about Elian Gonzalez, and I was like, where's the comparison though?
This is a different case in the sense that the parents. I mean, there's a clear. The parents did not have. Custody
right.
of the children, because there was a specific situation and there's a belief that the children can be in danger while they remain with the parents. There's not the political connotations that the Elian Gonzalez case had.
Right, the father.
Yeah, where the mother wanted to take him to freedom while the father was remaining in Cuba and he wanted him to come back. I mean, that part was missing from this. I think it was more of a clear case and you can only be glad that the best interest of the children were taken into consideration by both governments.
And one other thing related to Cuba this week, hip-hop mogul Jay-Z is responding to criticism that he and his wife, pop star Beyonce, received following their recent trip to Cuba. He released this song this week, a new song called Open Letter.
I'm in Cuba, I love Cuba. This communist talk is so confusing. I done turned Havana to Atlanta.
So in the song, and we'll let it fade out because there'll be a curse word there somewhere, but in the song, he also says politicians have never done anything for him except lie and distort history. He does not mention any of the lawmakers who criticized the couple for the trip. We heard from congressional Republicans Ileana Ross-Layton and Mario Diaz-Balart. By the way, condolences to Ileana Ross-Layton on losing her father this week. But both Republicans and Cuban Americans sent a letter to the Treasury Department asking about the trip. The Treasury Department says it was legal. How much of a firestorm did this kick up? up this week. Al, what do you think? Is this, in this grand scheme of things, a big deal?
From what I have understood and from what I have followed for years, U.S. residents can visit Cuba under some very, very specific limitations and requirements. And the bottom line is they filled out the paperwork, they put in the applications, they've got the money to do it, and they did it. And I don't understand personally why it's become such a major issue for them specifically when countless hundreds, if not thousands, of other U.S. residents go there and do the same thing without any kind of criticism whatsoever.
And President Obama has known to have close ties with Jay-Z and Beyonce, but a White House spokesman says the Obama administration has nothing to do with his visit, of course. That is the Treasury Department. All right, we're going to take a break. And Tolu Olorunipa has been very patient standing by in our Tallahassee Bureau. He's going to have the spotlight next as we talk state issues and lots of stuff to discuss there as we wrap up session. So stay with us. The Florida Roundup is back in just a moment. And welcome back to the Florida Roundup. I'm Phil Latzman, and we again introduce our panel, Al Sunshine from CBS4 Television, Teresa Frontado from El Nuevo Herald, and in Tallahassee with us is Tolu Olorunipa, who's a reporter for the Herald Times Tallahassee Bureau, does some fantastic work on citizens' property insurance, covers all kinds of things in the Capitol. And we're going to dive right into some of that stuff right now, Tolu. Governor Rick Scott has signed a bill that immediately bans all internet cafes in Florida. He signed this bill behind closed doors. Some upset, though, that the self-proclaimed jobs governor would sign a bill that would cost thousands of Floridians their jobs and also leave a lot of seniors here in South Florida without something to do. Scott met with reporters after he signed it.
It's the right thing to do for our state.
But what about all the people who will be out of work?
Well, I have a jobs agenda. You know, right now what the House and Senate should focus on is getting rid of the sales tax on manufacturing equipment. It'll create more manufacturing jobs.
So there's the line there, and the opponents of the ban have said the lawmakers in the internet cafe or industry, rather, employs about 1,300 Floridians. And the governor says the strip mall casino should never have been operating in the first place. But certainly, Tolu, this really got a fast track in Tallahassee, didn't it?
It's one of the fastest bills that have passed that I've seen. A lot of times when there's a scandal, the lawmakers want to create a task force or study the issue or have a working group. But this bill moved within a month of the lieutenant governor stepping down. She had to step down after a racketeering scandal was unveiled last month.
And she had done consulting work for one of the companies that was doing this internet cafe stuff illegally.
Yes, and this company also had given political contributions to lots of politicians. So this scandal spread very quickly through the Capitol, and lawmakers knew they had to do something really quickly. So they responded with a very fast ban, and the governor signed it within a month.
Al, we see seniors, we all know seniors that attend these types of things. From the Macanitas in Miami to Pembroke Pines and Century Village and all. I mean, this gives them something to do. But is this the right thing to do?
I think you have to absolutely look at balancing interests. It's a social phenomenon for people to go to these internet cafes, for them to get together, for them to chat, for them to engage online, for them to have opportunities. Unfortunately, a lot of those businesses took advantage, and they absolutely promoted illegal acts and a lot of illegal activities. And, you know, in the balance of interests, if somebody wants to get together with friends, they're still going to have their social halls. They're still going to have their own internet. So I think really what you're doing is probably limiting access to the organized internet cafes. But as far as the potential for people to find what they want to find online, they're still going to do it.
The other big issue that, and Tolu is the expert, both of you guys, since we have your expertise, have done an extensive amount of coverage of citizens' property insurance, both Al Sunshine and Tolu, who reports on this stuff from Tallahassee. Now, we have a bill that is making its way through the state legislature that could cause insurance rates to jump by more than 60% for citizens' customers in certain areas of the state, including parts of South Florida. Tolu, this is your beat. What is going on with this?
Well, it's a very complicated bill. It's about 100 pages. There's been about 36 amendments. Basically, the idea is to reform citizens' property insurance, make it much harder to get into the program. and force citizens to charge actuarially sound rates, which are basically market rates that you'd find in the private market. And here in Florida, several parts of the state, it's difficult to get private coverage because it's so risky and it's so expensive. And this bill would basically force citizens to charge market rates. And the idea is to get the private market back into Florida and basically increase rates on people so that the private market will take them over. There's been a lot of concern about how this would impact homeowners, how this would impact people who need to buy homes. And the Citizens President said for the first time that this bill would cause rates to increase by up to 60% in several parts of the state.
And the governor is now out asking that Citizens customers be kept under the current 10% annual rate hike cap. And so they'd have to go above and beyond the law here to make this happen, to increase their rates. How could they do that if they're legally mandated, I think, under the Crist administration, not to raise their rates by more than 10% a year?
Well, the idea behind this bill, I think, is to try to focus the rate increases on people who are coming into Citizens. So people who are currently under Citizens would be, to a certain extent, capped. But, of course, a lot of people are in Citizens, and then they get pulled out, and then they have to go back. And then that's an issue where people who are in Citizens could get hit with a big increase. And people who are either buying a home or moving from one home to another home, they'd be hit with that big increase as well. So this could have a pretty widespread impact. It's hard to tell exactly who would get hit. The bill has moved pretty fast without as much debate as you'd expect on such a major bill, but it's starting to pick up. There's starting to be some major debate on it now.
Al Sunshine, you have done an extensive amount of award-winning reporting on insurance, those types of issues here in South Florida, Citizens property insurance. How do you see this working out for people?
Well, the question that I have for Tolu also is that one of the provisions that's not getting very much attention at all is the ability for a private company to basically say, we are going to take over. You are not going to have the choice of refusing and opting out. A policy that for the first year could be potentially a 15% increase. And then the other disingenuous statement of the administration in Tallahassee about, oh, there's only a 10% increase in rates allowable is, well, the backdoor rate increases have been eliminating everybody's credits for storm mitigation, so that most homeowners have seen way, way beyond a 10% rate hike. And I had an opportunity of talking with Barry Gilway about a year ago when they held hearings here, and he was talking about, well, there needs to be opportunities for more companies to come in and take over policies. But the reality is that for I think a majority of people in South Florida, Dade, Broward, and perhaps even Palm Beach, and of course the Keys, there are not affordable private alternatives. And Phil, I can tell you, almost weekly, I get just these tragic emails from people saying, Al, I can't afford the insurance. I don't know what I'm going to do. And I hope that those messages are played for the lawmakers in Tallahassee to understand the results that it could have for people being literally priced out of home ownership in the state of Florida, because we all know on the other side of the coin, salaries are not keeping up. We've still got a severe unemployment problem in this state. For the most part, well-paying, full-time, full-benefit jobs are not replacing the jobs that have been eliminated, so home ownership is becoming that much more of a problem. The reality is also that the real estate lobby absolutely, for the first time, is starting to talk a lot more vocally about the inaffordability of insurance, possibly depressing and slowing down our very, very needed recovery in the real estate market.
Well, both of you, both you and Tolu. Tolu, if you want to add to that, but you've done some great reporting on Citizens property insurance. You want to wrap it up?
I was just going to say that Al brought up some very, very good points about sort of new policies versus old policies. The claim is that you get to keep your policy if you have it, but the bill does say that if another company comes in and says that they'll quote you a rate that's 15% higher, then you have to go out of Citizens. And a lot of what we've seen is that those takeout companies have gave a lower tease rate the first year, and then they hiked the rates very high the next year. And for those people, they would not be able to get back into Citizens at their previous rate. So it could have a major impact on those people. And Al brought up that point, and that's very important.
Now, the only thing that lawmakers are have to do every year is pass a budget. How is that shaping up, to Lou?
Well, in the Senate, the budget passed unanimously last year. This is the first year that lawmakers are offering such a large budget. We've seen cuts over the last couple of years during the recession, but this year things are very flush. The budget that's being considered is $74 billion, up from about $70 billion last year, and it includes raises for teachers, it includes raises for state workers, it includes more money for universities. So the Democrats and Republicans are coming together, at least on the Senate side, to pass a unanimous budget, which we haven't seen in the past. It's not necessarily a conservative budget because it's growing government at a pretty rapid clip. But now that there's the money to do that, the happy days are here again, one lawmaker said. On the House side, the one thing that's being considered and leading to some partisanship is the House does not want to go forward with expanding Medicaid in the way that Obamacare would do. It's about $51 billion over 10 years from the federal government that's hanging in the balance. And the Senate has a plan for accepting that money and covering more people. The House does not. So,
and that's really been the undercurrent this entire session. Why, you know, lawmakers have been dancing around this, but they have to figure something out in 3 weeks, right?
Well, that's very true. They've been kicking the can down the road. Some states with Republican governors have basically caved in and changed their position. Rick Scott did so about a month and a half ago, said, I want to accept this money and I want to expand Medicaid because the federal government's going to cover most of the cost. But, of course, there's the politics of quote-unquote Obamacare and how that doesn't gel with a lot of the conservatives in the House, including the Speaker of the House. So there's a big fight over whether or not this is going to go forward. The House has come out with an alternative plan, but it's much smaller and it covers far fewer people than the Senate plan. So they're going down to the wire. We'll see what happens as the House and the Senate try to negotiate and the governor tries to get his pitch across as well.
And to Lou, one final thing on the state level, at least, to talk about is to mention the ethics reform. Now, the House and the Senate both have ethics bills, but they can't agree on which ones to pass. Is that pretty accurate at this point? And what do they say?
Well, that is true, that they're looking at changing the way money impacts politics. We've had a couple scandals in the last few years, and we've seen the proliferation of these shadowy political committees that raise absurd amounts of money, and we don't really get to see exactly how the money's being spent. So both are trying to crack down on it. But one of the things that the House and the Senate are looking at doing is raising the individual contribution rate from $500 to as high as $3,000 or $5,000. And Governor Rick Scott came out this week and said that he would not sign that. He does not want higher contribution limits. And that has sort of thrown a wrench in some of the campaign finance reform. So we don't know exactly if things are going to actually get passed this year because there's a big debate over whether to increase the individual limit and how to deal with the fact that money is going to come into politics and how best to structure it.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Phil Latzman, our guest. That's Toulouse Olorunipa from the Miami Herald's Tallahassee Bureau. Also with us, Teresa Fontado from El Nuevo Herald, Al Sunshine from CBS 4 Television. And one quick call on state issues from Tameka, who is in Pembroke Pines. Welcome to the Florida Roundup. You have a question about the Stand Your Ground bill?
Yeah, I was wondering, was curious to see, I know that, I think it was Dwight Bullard had proposed some legislation that would repeal or amend the Stand Your Ground law. I wanted to follow up and see if there had been any movement on that.
Tulu, what do you know?
Great question. I followed the Stand Your Ground task force, which Governor Rick Scott commissioned last year, and they came up with some recommendations, and this year there was a bill to actually repeal Stand Your Ground, which the task force did not recommend. And there were some bills from the task force saying that we should tweak it. And there have been other gun bills. You know, the gun issue has been big nationally, but no gun bills, at least no types of gun control bills, have moved at all in the Florida legislature. They haven't gotten any hearings. There haven't been any workshops. There haven't been any committee meetings. The gun issue is just one issue that the Florida legislature does not want to debate, even as the national conversation is going on. So those Stand Your Ground repeal bills have not moved. They're dead for this session. It's not happening this year. And We'll have to wait until next year to see if anything happens.
Thanks, Tomeka, very much for the call. I didn't mean to cut you off. I hope you heard the response there. Al, a couple of things you're working on. But first of all, I wanted to talk about this signs of the sequester. We talk about the impacts. So we have Fleet Week that'll be fleetless because federal budget cuts that took effect March 1st due to the sequester forced the Navy to pull out of the two-decade-old event. Broward-based organizers of this year's Fleet Week planned for April 29th to May 6th. Say the show will go on, but without the Navy destroyers, cruisers, and submarines. This is it's become a tradition. We've all been to these events, and sad to see this go. This is just maybe the tip of the iceberg with the sequester cuts here.
Well, it absolutely is, and I think that this brings the message home that Congress's inability and the administration's inability to address issues, to find compromises, to solve problems does have a consequence, and even our ability to go and enjoy seeing our naval units come here, we're not seeing it. We're seeing fights for trying to keep some of the control towers open of some of the smaller airports around South Florida. And again, you know, let's point fingers where they are. This is a consequence of a inability for the administration and Congress to solve problems and come up with solutions to important issues.
Speaking of on the national level, Teresa, there's been controversy about Senator Marco Rubio's comments that there's no agreement yet on immigration reform. A lot of people waiting for that, Dreamers waiting for some conclusion on the Dream Act, and there's been basically no movement on immigration reform in Congress, and Senator Rubio's beginning to feel some of the heat here.
Well, yes, it's catching up with them because they raised hopes and now there's the expectation of a reform that's going to move fast. There was a big protest in front of the Capitol this week, and there's more and more demand from different sectors saying, "Hey, guys, when are you going to get this done?" So it's catching up with Rubio.
Yeah. So it's starting to ramp up a little bit. We should want to mention before we leave you about Holocaust Remembrance Day. I had a chance to attend an event on Sunday night at the Holocaust Memorial on Miami Beach, and it had happened at sundown. Miami Beach's Holocaust Memorial Museum held its own mourner's cottage service, if you will, on Sunday evening.
Laser, Laufmann, Mili, Lechmann, Carmen, Lerich, Rosa, Levy, Philip Levy, family Albert Levy, Emily Levy, Abraham Librader.
South Florida, home to one of the largest concentrations of Holocaust survivors in the world, Al, and their ranks are dwindling, though many did gather at the memorial to hear some of the names of those victims that are recorded there to remember and pay tribute to the 6 million Jewish victims of the Nazis during World War II. And, you know, we're working on a project. I'm working on something that I don't have time to talk about right now, but just to capture voices of people that went through that. Still very difficult for people, even in their 80s and 90s, to talk about what happened. And a lot of them are here.
And we will never forget, both as a nation and as a people, and we will honor their memory, and we will do whatever we can to make sure it never happens again.
Here, by the way, is 85-year-old Simon Shevlin, who is a survivor and a docent at the Miami Beach Memorial.
There's only a handful of people like me that survived, that are willing to tell this story. I'm 85. In a couple of years, I wouldn't be here. There is an awful lot of people that don't believe it happened.
And it's estimated that 10,000 survivors remain in Miami-Dade. And this is, Teresa, final note quickly. When I was at this ceremony on Sunday night, I met two or three survivors that came from Venezuela recently to escape Chavez because mm-hmm. of the anti-Semitism that was perceived in that country, in your country.
It is. It was. It's something of a newer trend that we have not experienced before. And the Chavez government sided with the Palestine in the conflict and was very vocal in blaming the Jewish population in the country, and it opened the way for some acts of violence against synagogues and attacks in the country that have forced some people
out to come here. Al, we didn't have time. I'm sorry that we didn't get to your identity theft story, but I do want to mention just quickly what you've been working on at CBS4 because we feel I didn't give it justice.
Well, I could tell you, Phil, that as we approach the April 15th deadline, we're going to have a whole new group of people realizing that their tax identities have been stolen. There are estimates that it could be costing the federal government as much as $21 billion. And, of course, we're number one. This is ground zero for the problem.
And you've been reporting on that, and we look forward to seeing that on CBS4 TV. Thanks to Tolu Olorunipa in Tallahassee, Teresa Frontado here in Miami, along with Al Sunshine from CBS4. If you missed the show, we're back on the air at 6 a.m. with a repeat tomorrow or online at WLRN.org. We're produced by Alicia Zuckerman, Elaine Chen, Public Insight Network analyst Steph Farrow, social media editor Danny Rivero. For WLRN, the executive producer is Peter J. Meritz, Dan Gretsch, Paul Leary. Thank you so much. South Florida Arts Beat is next. I'm Phil Latzman. Stay informed, South Florida.